Just following on from John's welcome to everyone, my name's Mick Burke, I'm the Chairman of EPA Victoria and I'm the facilitator of the panel session today. I suppose for every one of us, almost every activity we involve ourselves in any day brings with it the use of some form of energy. Most of the energy we generate here in Victoria is carbon intensive. We know quite clearly that excess carbon CO2 emissions bring about some of the warming that's generating long-term climate change. Today onwards, we're really working on a carbon-constrained future. And that's a fairly significant challenge for us all. But I think both our environment and our economy is going to adjust to a lower diet in regard to carbon emission. We know that there are some practical and sensible ways to achieve this, and industry in Victoria worked through a program with my organisation over the last 3 or 4 years, which saw in Victoria a reduction of over 1 million tonnes of CO2 emission, and at the same time saw net returns to the industry sector of $34 million a year. The concept of doom and gloom is one we need to dispel with the concept that, in fact, as we move through and manage the adjustments to climate change and reductions in carbon to atmosphere, that we will, in fact, grow community wealth in that process. So it's an opportunity more than it is a problem. That takes creativity and innovation, and we see examples of that in many places at the present time. Again, our organisation is structuring a carbon innovators network where we think the dialogue and discussion around ways to meet the challenge will be valuable for all players. Recent times we've committed our organisation and actually delivered our organisation into a carbon neutral status, really so that, one, we could learn how that can be done, not only technically but also physically and also financially. And we can see very shortly that being carbon neutral will be at least cost neutral, if not positive in terms of income for the organisation. But that's not the focus of today. Today we're here for our conversation with carbon innovators. We've got 5 significant leaders, as John said in the outset, national, international, who are responding to the challenge and will take us through a discussion in just a short while. Firstly, though, I'd like to introduce the first of the panel members who will address us, and that's Dr. Paul Thiebaud. Paul's a former Vice President of DuPont, well recognised here in Victoria as well as in many other places, and a great contributor to business sustainability and improved business results and outcomes. Paul, welcome to the podium.
Thanks very much, Mick. Delighted to be here. Good. I hope you recognize this picture. It's one of my favorites. I took it one Saturday morning when the air was just crystal clear and smooth. I'm told that the next time I come, if I can get one with it raining, everybody be delighted. So that's what I'm going to do 2 things very quickly. I'm going to quickly run through the growing business case for working on carbon, and it's becoming more and more positive. And the second thing is I'm going to give you 8 steps that people who are leaders in this area tend to follow when they get committed to make action. But let me begin with kind of a statement. Science is clear. The impacts are real and increasingly visible. The business case is very robust and is moving to market-based improvements. And leadership actions are critically necessary to manage carbon, and they're needed now. This is an example of several companies that have stepped forward. You can see the kind of reductions that they've made. Probably none of them knew they could do this quicker and further than they thought they could. The ones that I think are particularly good go like this: 10% reduced, $650 million saved. 50% reduction, $310 million saved. And my favorite, 72% reduction and $3 billion saved. This is a different picture of carbon management than we had just a few years ago. My real favorite was not on that slide. It's EPA Victoria Carbon Neutral. And they're showing it can be done. And I expect next time I come, I'll see a number of more companies and organizations commit to this. The business case historically is around reducing risk, but now it's about reducing energy waste and cost. It's about bringing products to the market that help your customers and consumers reduce energy. It's about building a reputation as a responsible leader. And it's also, in many cases, building a product portfolio that's going to improve and be better than your competition as the price of carbon rises. This is an example from Vic Super. It's a traditional way of thinking, but today it's big money. $31 trillion have been identified with climate change as a risk. And in many places, people are lobbying to have this put on your balance sheet as an acknowledged risk to your business. And sometimes negative drivers are terrifically important. But this chart is the one I like. It's a DuPont chart. From 1990 to 2005, the company reduced total energy use by 6%, while production went up 40%. The cumulative savings were over $3 billion. Many people think one of the largest market opportunities being created today is the opportunity to help your customers and consumers save energy. These are a few examples of some of the fastest growing business opportunities available. My own case, I was in a company that was viewed as on the worst list in 1995, and in 2005 was on the best list. A lot of that was not solely reductions in climate gases, but a great deal of it was. I tell you, life's a lot better on the right side. The last point I want to make is there's a growing set of industries that are going to be fed by the increasing price of carbon or the scarcity, however you want to look at it, or the need for security of energy. And this is an example of a real pilot facility that's going to be running and then commercialized to build a whole slate of petrochemical fuels from corn as a fuel base. And if you're in the corn business, this is a terrifically good time for you because demand is far outstripping supply. I don't know how many of you have seen this report. It was sponsored by the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. It's available on their web. It's about benchmarking companies that are leaders in the field, and it was written by a fellow named Andrew J. Hoffman from the University of Michigan. The advice in the report is far beyond what I'm going to spend my time on. I'm just going to give you the highlights. But he's not only taken everything he's heard and put it into 8 steps, but he's got very good studies on companies like Alcoa, Swiss Re, DuPont, and others. The first step, and there are 4 parts to this, is assess the emissions profile. You can't get started unless you know where all your carbon is. One of the real benefits of going carbon neutral is you have to figure out where it all is. And when people figure out where it all is, it's easier and much easier to figure out how to reduce it. Secondly, you need to gauge the risk and opportunities. What risks are posed by the emissions from your operations? And today, more and more people are thinking about the risk if they have high energy intensity products. Where can we beat competition by getting ahead? How may the demand for our products and services change? and what products and services may flourish in a carbon-constrained economy? And then what are your options? What options do you have? I'm a fan of Pareto analysis. Where can you get the biggest bang for the buck? And what you find is you can actually be making money very early. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit. How can we innovate? What long-run steps can we take? And how can climate-related strategies enhance top-line and bottom-line objectives? This is a hugely different conversation just 5 years ago, where people were talking about huge amounts of money simply to reduce things to be a good citizen. This is now a business issue being driven for both reduction, but more importantly, product-oriented opportunity. And then if nothing else, set a target. What kinds of efficiencies? My recommendation is set an absolute goal. Don't talk about 5% improvement in efficiency. My favorite goal is zero new net energy while you grow. You get there much quicker, and your value to your operation or business is much greater. How can the targets be connected to business? And what kind of goals are achievable regarding new business opportunities? I don't know how many of you have goals that talk about the number of products or the amount of R&D you're going to put into products and services that can help your customers and consumers reduce energy in use. Once you start doing this, it becomes a very real opportunity-driven subject. The second major area has two steps. Develop the financial mechanisms. There's a lot of differing options here, whether you set cap and trade, do internal trading, shadow pricing. Do you fool with your hurdle rates? I recommend you don't. All these projects need to meet the normal hurdle rates you have for your business. And do you need any special capital reserves? And then how can you get everyone involved? How do you engage the organization so that everyone's participating and helping make the reductions? Quick example on waste. DuPont had a site with waste. They took every employee during the period of a day to see every piece of waste on the site. You know what happens? Everybody's working on reducing it. So getting the organization engaged is terrifically powerful. And then focus outward. And here there are two very critical steps that not enough companies are taking. But think through the policy that would be helpful as you move forward, particularly on the opportunity side. How might policies help or hurt business and our ongoing climate-related activities? What options are already on the table? What would be good policy options to promote? A number of the leading companies in the U.S., the CEOs, have actually lobbied the Bush administration for a 30% reduction in climate gases over the next 10 to 15 years. Now, this hasn't been heard clearly yet, but the business people are on record as saying we need this kind of option because it's good for our business. And the last, and I don't like the word manage, external relations, but it really is meant to say, who do you need to interact with outside of your business that can be very important to achieving your strategies? Are there NGO organizations, industry groups? Are there government groups that can really make you drive the change in your business in a positive way? So this is kind of the setup for the real reason you came, which is to hear from the carbon innovators. So let me just close with where I started. I think all of you are probably where I am, to say that the time for action is now. The time for action is now. And the more that it's driven from an opportunity standpoint, the more it will be a sustainable thought within business. And that's my hope, and I see a lot of that happening right here in Victoria. So thank you, and Mick, what do we do next?
Thanks very much, Paul. Well, at this point, we will ask the other members of the panel to come up to the stage if they wouldn't mind, and I'll introduce them by way of asking them each a question once they've seated, just so you can hear a little bit from them, and then we'll open to the floor for further questions.
First of all, Anne Barker, who's the Managing Director of City West Water, is with us. Anne, I understand we're in a severe drought. I would have thought that the only priority you have is to keep finding water for us. So why on earth would you be interested in becoming greenhouse neutral?
To quote Paul, I think the science is clear, and one of the things that it's telling us is that climate change is having a very significant effect on the amount of water that's available. And as a responsible water business, I think that it's very important that we set an example to other businesses to say that we've all got to do something about this problem, and we have a particular interest, because the less water there is, the more we have to manufacture it. The more we have to manufacture it, the more we're just adding to the problem. So that's why we've gone greenhouse neutral, and we should be able to achieve that target by the end of this financial year.
That's great. Thanks, Ian. Michael Catchpole at the end of the panel. Michael's the CEO of the Plastic and Chemicals Industry Association here in Australia. Michael, I suppose your association is really set up to support the long-term viability of your member companies. As an association, you've probably got a fairly small carbon footprint. Why do you think that moving towards carbon neutrality in your own association is important, and what do you think it really means against the carbon footprint of those that are members of your association?
Thanks, Mick. Yes, certainly our sector is energy intensive, as you say, but our association representing the sector is small. It's a small business. And for us to move to carbon neutrality is, I suppose, part of that first step that Paul noted, and that is to, first of all, assess your emissions position, both internally within our own operation, and we hope from that to use that as a learning exercise and then be able to assist our member companies, some of whom already are on the path of assessment and, in fact, addressing some of their major emissions targets. But others, I'd have to say, are only now coming to terms with the fact that this is something they will have to do. And that certainly applies for the small to medium member companies. And I suppose our operation as an association is probably most relevant to them. And what we learn from going carbon neutral ourselves, I believe we can then help them apply in that first step.
Thank you. Next to Michael is Phil Craig, and Phil's the General Manager of Sales and Marketing with Origin Energy, and I think I'm one of your customers, Phil. And
nice to hear.
Therefore, your job's to supply energy or provide energy, and most of the energy produced here in Australia is rather carbon intensive. So it wouldn't be unusual for those in that business to be keeping their head down a little bit in this debate. Yet when we hear Origin Energy as a name, it's synonymous with carbon innovation. Why is that so?
Good question. I guess the way we view this issue is that we are at the centre of the issue as an energy provider, and that brings both responsibility and opportunity. We feel if there is going to be innovation, then it's going to come largely from our sector. We have 2.5 million customers around Australia, so most of the emissions are not our own direct emissions, but are the emissions of our customers. And we realised a long time ago that we were on this sort of wave of understanding of what we were doing to the environment, and we wanted to link both what we could do in terms of corporate social responsibility and doing the right thing with helping our customers understand the issue and do the right thing, and also link that to commercial benefit for the organisation going forward. And one of the things with this is, initially in the debates, you find people think that doing the right thing is just going to cost you money. And I think one of the things that Paul pointed out is that that's not true at all, that energy efficiency and that understanding where the market is going to go is actually a really positive thing for the business. So we sit here with, we'll have 200,000 customers on green electricity and gas products at the middle of the year, and really well positioned for the future, which is what we're all about.
So now our fifth panel member is Chris Barker, and Chris is Pilkington Australia's Manager of Marketing and Business. And we haven't seen each other since breakfast, when we signed a sustainability covenant with the CEO and other organisations. And that covenant was part of supporting an initiative that your company's entering into here in Victoria, Chris, where they're going to spend over $130 million on a high-technology glass production facility. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that investment, Chris, and why that's part of Pilkington's strategy to innovate in the face of climate change.
Sure. Thanks, Mick. From Pilkington's in the enviable situation, I guess, where we have a manufacturing facility that has to be upgraded. And when we started the process and we talked to Paul over 2 years ago now and looked at what the options were, we manufacture here in Victoria primarily commodity float glass. And not too far away in Asia, there are about 200 of these commodity float lines that can import into Australia exactly the same product that that we make. So we're on a hiding to nowhere. So what we needed to look at was what we could do through adopting the best technology by going down an innovation path that both led to above the line and below the line benefits in energy efficiency through delivery of reduction in greenhouse gases. So the below the line type of strategies are that we look at the energy it takes to produce every tonne of glass, and we've set ourselves a target in the design stage to reduce that that energy by around about 15%. We also understand the water that's used, and we've set ourselves targets to continually use less water through the manufacturing process. But it's the above-the-line area where there's really a lot of upside. In Australia, energy-efficient glass is something that's available, but really not many people understand it. And this investment that we're putting in is going to be a high-tech, one of only five lines in the world from a Pilkington perspective that can produce glass with microscopically thin layers of metals laid over it when it's in the molten stage to alter the properties of that glass so that it becomes a low E glass, which is an insulating glass. It can have solar control properties. It can have self-cleaning properties, and that enables us to see water use reduced. It can have other properties as well. Generally, standard glass in a building envelope accounts for about 9% of the total envelope area. Yet standard glass allows the escape of about 63% of heat. About 91% of unwanted heat gain comes straight through that. So there's huge benefits for the upstream reduction of greenhouse gases through the reduction of heating and cooling energy that are required in the built environment. So it's the upside that is very important, and it's sort of the signing of the partnership. I was watching Paul's notes up there, his eight steps, and I think we've ticked off a fair few of them. It's bringing in the EPA, bringing in the government, working together to understand that we've been trying to get these changes happening over a long period of time, yet we haven't been successful much. What have we got to do to change attitudes? So it's an education, it's government leadership, it's industry leadership. So big upsides and big opportunities.
We've probably got a good half hour, and there's microphones placed strategically around the room, as they always seem to be. And it's your opportunity now to engage in the conversation with these five carbon innovators. So all I'd ask is if you've got a question, a comment or a thought, if you could make your way to one of the microphones, you can address it to one member of the panel or to the panel as a whole. And we'll get that conversation happening. So what we need is a couple of early takers, and we have one moving there. You might just identify yourself, if that's okay.
Hi, Leyland Gaddy from True Energy. Interested in hearing comments about, well, in an environment where there's increasing concern from the community that corporations are not doing enough to address the climate change problem, how do you in all your corporation address the issue of the concerns of all the carbon neutrality plans being just greenwash, basically just nice to have for reputation but not going far enough in really addressing the problem?
Who'd like to take that one, Michael?
I'm not sure that I'd like to, but I think it's the most important and very good question. I think that's a perfectly legitimate question that the community will ask, and certainly from our industry point of view, The chemicals industry is heavily regulated, and for good reason. However, what we are now seeing is that major companies globally and in Australia are moving much more towards meeting community expectation rather than merely regulation. And as the question suggested, community expectation is actually moving so much faster than any regulator could hope, even the most efficient regulators, Mick. So that what we're seeking to do, of course, is then to capitalise on the opportunity that Paul talked about, and Paul has introduced that sort of thinking to many of our companies over the last couple of years. So from our point of view, simply meeting regulation or producing a policy that has perhaps a short life but then is determined to be greenwash simply won't work. And what we're finding, of course, is that even in the last 6 months, there's been such a shift in public perception, public understanding, and public expectation around climate change and what industry must do to do its share to reduce the impact of climate change. And that's certainly what we're attempting to address.
I think that it's a very good question. And one of the issues which is very important in all of this is disclosure. And a lot of businesses, particularly the ones who are really sincere about achieving sustainability targets, are tending to do things like issue sustainability reports or very comprehensive disclosures in their annual reports about the environment. There's a global set of rules called the Global Reporting Initiative, which has very clear requirements for auditing of the claims that you're making in your sustainability report. The City West Water has been putting one of these together for about 5 years now, I think, and we've been complying with the Global Reporting Initiative rules for at least the last three. And that I think that kind of disclosure, where you're really putting all of the information out into the public so that they can see what your starting point was, they can see all of the initiatives that you've implemented and the point that you reach at the end of every year. I would hope that that kind of really very detailed disclosure does provide some reassurance to the community that it's not just talk.
Can I add something too? Just picking up on the sustainability point, we've just last April released our fifth annual sustainability report, sixth one coming. We've had a look at how we upgrade what we've done. So not only have we been doing that for 5 years, but we're looking at how we can do it better. We're very, very careful within Origin that we walk the talk, that we don't say these things and not do them internally. So we're investing in solar technology. We are the leading installer of solar PV around Australia as well. We offset all of our company travel and all of our company vehicles, and we buy green power for all of our offices, shops, depots. Not something we communicate broadly, but we do it. And we make sure that internally people are understanding that it's not something that we're telling others to do, but that we're prepared to do it ourselves. We're also, I mentioned before, the customers, because most of the emissions are through our customers. We have a target for the next 5 years that with the mass market customers, residentials and small business, that we will get to a 50% reduction in emissions from those customers compared to levels of today. So we're setting ourselves quite high targets as well.
Thanks, Bill. I see we've got some further questioners queuing, so we'll take another.
Hi, my name's Jeff Robinson, and I work for a company called Connell Wagner. And we help our clients to design new buildings and to refurbish existing buildings. And my question for the panel, and in fact anyone maybe by a show of hands in the audience, how many of you in your own businesses are looking at your existing building stock or your choices in terms of new buildings and new tenancies and saying, I want to reduce my emissions, not by just writing a check and buying trees, but by the actual practical measures, the day-to-day things that say, I want to work in a building that reduces its energy usage, its water usage, its waste usage, and creates a healthier environment for the employees. I'd just be interested not only in the brand new shiny buildings, but also, you know, the buildings that have been around for many, many years in this city, that need upgrade. I'd just be interested not only in the panel, but maybe by a show of hands, people in organizations as to whether you're starting to think in that kind of way. Not nearly enough hands up.
Jack will be collecting cards shortly. Chris?
It is a good point, and to say that at Pilkington we had a rollout plan is perhaps overstating it, but we are currently refurbishing our 1960s head office out in Dandenong, and of course we're using fantastic energy efficient glass. But I think and we're using that to achieve the full result, and I've expressed before our targets in the manufacturing environment. Your question is slightly different. But taking it on a more global picture, and if we just talk, let's keep it nice and local in Victoria, we build around about 40,000 new homes per annum in Victoria, including multi-unit apartments. And even if we fix those buildings energy efficiently and get them to perform as well as technology can allow them, there's probably something in the vicinity of 3 million existing homes that do not perform. So unless we all start to take that, the 40,000 each year going forward is really just a trickle in the ocean, and we will not become carbon restrained in the future unless we do start to do that. And the performance from about the 70s onwards, you insulate, you seal up the major gaps, and here's the ad, you start to address glass because, as I said, it's the major source of heat loss. And there are products which will improve it by around 40% cost effectively. So there are cost effective solutions out there.
Yeah, I'm going to probably get in trouble with what I'm going to say here, but this relates to your question and the previous one. I believe the business community has kicked in very strong. And the thing that excites me is they're above the line now as well as working below the line, because that'll be sustainable, because it plays to the way the business model works. I'd be the first to say, though, that the business community hasn't done enough. Okay? Is that fair? So there's more to be done. I think governments have stepped in very strongly, too. EPA Victoria, for instance, makes sure people have showers so that when they ride their bikes to work, they have the complete system. I worked in a place where they had an exercise room but no shower. Sounds pretty good, right? The group that hasn't kicked in is the public. Okay, I live in a country where we have more cars than we have people. The average density per day on the road is 1, unless you're in a Hummer where it's 0.5 because you have 2 cars and you're 1 driver. I'm real serious about this. If you use that 8-step list and you did as an individual, how many of those steps have I worked through or the public's worked through? Because this thing called conservation or smart use of resources is a really powerful tool. And by the way, it's not only cheap, but it improves quality of life. I was told the other day that the average Victorian uses 200 liters of water per day. The theoretical minimum is 6. Now, that's pretty tight, right? See, you probably have better data than I have. But, you know, when you move from carbon to water, the situation's even worse about knowing the baseline data. And so I think getting information to the public, because I think the public wants to do the right thing, but the information and the ways to go about it is going to be critical. Once the public kicks in, I think this thing will take and we'll solve the problem.
Rob?
Thanks, Mick. You've reminded us how energy intensive we are in this state in particular, in both transportable fuels and our access to energy from brown coal. I wonder whether Phil could clarify for me, in the sense of following on from the greenwash question, you sell green power, how much renewable energy is in your product, and there are other products in the marketplace as well. And how do the, for example, the Victorian government's initiative 10% MRET by 2016, or the federal one at 2%, how do those sort of regulations, how do they improve, or how do they manage that market? Or I guess the question is, how much renewable energy can you buy? Is there enough? Do you want more?
Yep.
Are you greenwashing us?
The government requirements are basic requirements that we meet through our supply portfolio. Everything we sell to the public is in addition to that. So we don't work one against the other, or play one against the other, if you like. We have a range of products. We have 100% renewable products. So we have a 100% wind product and a 100% solar product. It's very clear what they are. and they are quite expensive, much more expensive than standard power out of the grid. We also have a base product, which is probably the one that's become the most popular, which is a 20% new renewables product, backfilled with 80% existing hydro. So it's a zero emissions, if you like, but the backfill is already there. Now, that's a very marketable product because it's $1 a week, so that's why we've had the significant take-up. It's 20% new renewable, not 100% renewable. What we try to do is get customers in on that initial product and then upsell them to the 100% wind or 100% solar. Is there enough renewable energy at the moment? Yes. But looking at the growth path, the exponential growth we've had in sales of green products and sales that other companies are now starting to follow in this path, then we do need new projects coming online, and there's signs that that's happening. What people should look for is a clear articulation, if they're going to take a green product, of what that split is, because there are products on the market that don't have the green tick, don't have the government green tick, are not appropriately accredited. Every single one of our products is. I'm not sure if that's true of everyone, but I'm not going to give you specific examples.
Thanks, Bill.
Yes. Carl. Carl Carthy, Greening Australia. I think it's admirable about Pilkington, hearing about the glass. I think it's admirable about the green power that's available. Drive any direction out of Melbourne, and what do you see? You see McMansions. You see no eaves. You don't see water tanks. You don't see solar panels, and you think because there's a pond put in that you walk around to have lifestyle, that we're all happy. We really need to be getting right back down to what the footprint is of individuals, not just about how much more we can consume. And I think that that is a big discussion about legislation. You know, putting eaves on houses over your glass would certainly help, rather than the great air conditioning units that I see. Yes.
Yeah, design plays an important part, and you know, the facts are that since 1960 through to now, we've increased the floor space of our houses by something like 44% or something like that, yet we're living fewer people in those houses. So you answer the logic behind that. The other side of that, which is a manufacturer, is that in those larger houses, they're using lots and lots more glass. So from our perspective, yes, there's got to be a fix of the product, but selection and the mixing and matching, taking advantage of north-facing windows with appropriate shading, understanding mechanical shading on the western elevation, understanding some of the laws of thermodynamics that work would certainly help. And I think that's still part of, for example, our efforts with the sustainability and EPA, is about education. It's about getting the message out that it isn't just about putting that glass on every window. It's about starting to make clever choices. So, yes, there's a lot of work to do. But I guess from a manufacturer, looking at what the opportunities are in the future and then investing to take advantage of those opportunities, and even with Rob's view, we're designing our plant to be able to produce very thin, low-iron glass that we can mirror here in Victoria for use in the pilot heliostat solar system. Now, you know, that's a risk strategy, because will it happen? Will we make clean coal become more expensive so that these solar products are more compatible, comparable in price? We don't know. So there's an element of risk business must manage, but at the same time open yourself up to the potential future benefits, which is, you know, this has got to be sustainable profit-wise as well. So, yeah.
Thank you. Gordon Hollands is my name. My question's primarily to Paul, but I'd be interested in the panel's view. Paul, you started today's presentation indicating that the business case for climate change was clear. I don't disagree with you. I'm on your side. However, I wonder if it's widely accepted in corporate Australia. Let me point you to a recent survey by KPMG in the State of Sustainability Reporting in Australia. That report indicated otherwise. So my question is, why is that? What's stopping corporate Australia from getting on board here?
Well, you know, I don't really know the answer. I didn't use a lot of Australian companies on the slide because I assume maybe that was well known what was going on here, and I've heard many companies here that are moving forward. All I know is the business case is significantly strengthened when you start thinking about the growth of products and services versus simply reducing things at the manufacturing site. And in fact, that multiple of the good you can do in terms of dealing with climate and carbon is probably 10, and I think you talked about 40x multiple once you get out in the market. And I don't think enough companies have taken this concept of sustainability yet and thought about the top line. They're still wrestling with the bottom line. And a lot of the stuff I do is try to get businesses to think about that top line. Once you get up there, then you've got unlimited opportunities to grow your business and help deal with the carbon issue. But I don't have a direct answer of why it's not taking up more quickly.
I think if I might, certainly I saw that report. In fact, we discussed it at our conference last year, and there's no doubt that I think the standard of sustainability reporting has to be raised, but of course that has to reflect the actuality. And in many cases, what we're finding is that corporate Australia is only taking that first or second step. Those companies that do have credible reporting systems would be very much in the minority across whatever sector you were looking at. However, they are already setting the standard, setting the lead, and I think that they're the ones that we need to look to, both within industry associations and within individual companies, as the examples that we need to follow. So I think that there is a start there, but I don't think there are too many companies who could be too self-satisfied about how far they've got at this stage.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Patterson. I'm from ANZ. And congratulations in achieving a near carbon neutral position. What I'd like to know is how you've gone about achieving that. And secondly, in terms of carbon offsets, I'd like the panel to explain to me what their view is on using a REC, for example, which is renewable energy offset, as opposed to a New South Wales gas abatement certificate, and what you think the difference is.
What we first of all try to do is reduce the energy that we're using at the moment, and that we're certainly interested in trying to get up a business case to occupy much more sustainable premises than we're in at the moment. But we also look at all of the energy use that we've got in those premises and upgrading fixtures and fittings so that we're reducing energy use. We have a lot of pumps and other energy using equipment out in the network, and so it's very important that all of those are maintained so that they are operating at an optimal level and reducing the amount of energy that they're using too. The second part of our approach is that we look at purchasing renewable energy as well. So there's a component of that in the energy that our whole business consumes. And the third part of our strategy is to do with the showerhead exchange that we're operating at the moment. All of the water businesses across Victoria are offering this too. The average reduction in greenhouse gases that between a standard showerhead and a water-efficient showerhead is about 2.7 tonnes of greenhouse a year. So it's you really do get some remarkable energy savings as well as water savings from those. And so we're looking at adding all of those things together to achieve a carbon neutral outcome. It's very important that we're moving on this now because we're all looking for alternate sources of water, and those alternate sources of water like recycling are very energy intensive. And so if we've got our program going now, it's going to enable us to continue to produce more water using those sorts of technologies, but at the same time maintain greenhouse neutrality.
Bill, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you seem best fitted to answer the second part of the question.
Yeah, well, obviously we buy RECs and NGACs and GACs in Queensland, and I suspect there's going to be a whole lot of... Hopefully you heard that. A whole lot of other types of credits available as we go forward. I noticed Landcare announced this morning they're going to be putting tree planting organisations in connection with business. We've been working through, we would like to have a role in that as well, and we've been working through what that means. I guess what you've got to look at is what the impact of those different credits is, what you're getting, what the governance is, what kind of outcomes you get as a result of buying the credits. I'm not sure there's a right answer. I think all schemes that we have seen are heading in the right direction, trying to achieve the right sort of outcome. Some will fall over along the way and some will develop. We would love to see a single national scheme with a single credit mechanism, but I'm not sure when that's going to come. And I think you'll find lots of little voluntary schemes jumping up along the way, and all these things will start to interact. It's a matter of being cautious and careful. And one of the things, again, coming back to our wanting to walk the talk, is being very careful about governance and making sure we're doing the right thing. So if we enter that sort of market, we'll be very careful about explaining what we're doing, how we're doing, why we're doing it, and having some sort of advisory group to make sure that there's an independent assessment of what we're doing. Not sure if that helps you.
I was over in London in the Chatham House giving a talk on DuPont's work on climate. Somebody from the audience from Greenpeace stood up, dressed in a nice suit, and said, "Are you for a cap and trade system?" Now, in business, you're not supposed to be for cap and trade. Turns out I'm hugely for cap and trade. There needs to be some standard that says where we're going, and then some mechanism to optimize the system. And at some point, planting trees is not going to be sufficient. We need to go where the highest value in the society is to reduce emissions and allow people to trade so that we're not doing the low-value, high-cost. DuPont reduced greenhouse gas emissions 72%, most of it non-CO2, and we went to the UK where there was a cap-and-trade system and we sold $50, $60 million worth of credits. The U.S., the price is much lower, so there's not as much. But without some kind of standard, I prefer a standard, by the way, that's set on a proactive basis versus being a restricted standard where you're forced into it, where you set 30% change, so you have to really change, not just tighten up. But then you've got to let the free market system optimize the use of resources to meet it. So it turns out I was really for what Greenpeace was for, which I found over and over again to be true.
I always like it when Paul talks about a role for regulators in these in the process.
Carolyn.
MIT here in Melbourne. I wanted to pick up on some of those thoughts and, Paul, your comments on business lobbying government for further action in the US and the extent to which we could look to business leaders such as those represented on the panel to actually be lobbying for further action at federal level in particular to set the sort of standards that you're talking about, Paul, in order to raise potentially the lowest common denominator so that other businesses can come on board and you're not out there so far ahead leading the pack and look around and no one's following. And I ask in particular of Phil, given that Origin Energy is on the Business Roundtable for Climate Change and one of the stated objectives of that group is actually working with government.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to... Yeah, policy leadership has been a key element of our positioning in this regard. We have been arguing for a national trading scheme for many years now. You're right, we're part of the Business Roundtable. We regularly have conversations with government at all levels, and not just about national schemes, but also about policy directions in individual states, decisions in individual states. Obviously, from my own personal perspective, my part of the business, we have pricing discussions, and we've also had talks about how do you price standard grid electricity versus green products and how do you start to incentivate people to take green products. I think it's fair to say that up until probably 6 to 12 months ago, some of those comments weren't as positively reacted to as they have been recently. And I suspect we'll see a whole lot more movement in regard to some of those things, but we see it as critical that we're consistent in everything we do, that it's policy, it's lobbying, it's discussions with government, and it's what we do internally, and it's what we do with customers.
Michael?
I think, picking up on Phil's point about the rather exponential change in the politicisation of all of the measures to address climate change, I think most industry could be, not accused, but it could be said that we've been caught rather short by the very rapid change in public opinion, public expectation, understanding of these issues. I came this morning along with one of my colleagues and other colleagues I see now in the room, from a council meeting where we were looking at our own association position on particularly greenhouse gas emissions and some form of emissions trading scheme as one of the measures to address that. I have to say that our organisation has moved a long way from 3 years ago when we had a simple, flat, standard no to any question about emissions trading or any other greenhouse gas abatement system. We are not yet at the full policy development and release stage, but our board in December said that it was no longer possible for any industry association or indeed company to stand out and say that they would not or could not address climate change, address their own emissions, address their own footprint. And I think that it's recognised that this level of expectation also is already impacting on share value. And if nothing else, then shareholder expectation will drive many companies. It may not be the most altruistic reason for making change, but it's certainly a very effective one.
Can I just make one additional comment? We have a view at Origin, we don't wait for government. And if you know something's right and you know it's commercially sensible, you don't need to wait for a policy direction or a regulatory direction. You can get out there and make it happen.
Let me add one other thought, because your question suggests that if you lead, you may not win. But if you're thinking of this as a cost, there's no reason to lead. If you're creating the opportunities, you always want to lead. And so getting that mindset to the right place is important. The other thing, we just suffer as a world that we don't have something you can trade, because CO2 anywhere in the world is the same. We don't have something we can move around. So we're always going to sub-optimize the system unless we get something that we can move things around in this area.
Hi, Alan Glimworth from Maunsell, Australia. Question for Phil. How is Origin assisting its customers, particularly the corporate customers, understand their emissions profiles?
I've got to say we've had a lot more success in the mass market than we have in the large business market, although the large business market, probably the last 12 to 18 months, we've started to see a lot more interest and understanding in this area. We have an energy services group that offers efficiency measurement services, efficiency improvement services. We also obviously offer green power products and offsets products to business. Probably 2 years ago, we were offering those products and not getting very much interest. We now virtually always get asked to quote a green product, and we've recently seen some pretty major companies, GPT, IBM and some others, and government obviously leading the way, taking green power products and interested in looking at what they're doing with their own consumption. So I think we're earlier in the curve than we are with the mass market, but it seems to be about to take off. And we obviously provide efficiency services, products, whatever business requires, but hopefully we'll see a real growth in demand in that in the next sort of 12 months.
Given that numbers still drive the world, you make providing a simpler service for customers so that if they do want to find out what kilowatts they're using and therefore what greenhouse they're emitting.
Absolutely, yeah. In all business quotes anyway, we look at current consumption and what can be done to improve that consumption.
We've probably got time for one more quick question, if anyone had one. Yes, we've got a gentleman who's been standing there for some time.
Chris Case from Clayton Utes Lawyers. In my previous career, I used to be an engineer modelling process facilities. I was at Shell Geelong. And one of the things I noticed in the modelling activities was the sensitivities of price of carbon dioxide. And I haven't heard from the panel today what pricing of carbon dioxide has been used in the economic modelling the business case argument's been presented. Has the panel got any views on that, please?
Cool. Back in 1980, DuPont owned an oil company called Conoco. They were the best in the world, and they told us in the year 2000 the price of oil would be $100 a barrel. And so we built a manufacturing facility to last 30 years based on $100 a barrel of oil, and it got shut down in 6 months because the price of oil stayed below $20 a barrel for the next 20, 25 years. And so dependability for the business community on the price of carbon is hugely important. And unless there's some cap or something that signals how that's going to happen, the business community will sit there continually trying to figure, is it going to go up or down and all that kind of thing. So these business leaders in the U.S. that lobbied the U.S. government for a 30% reduction over, I think, 10, 15 years, were doing it because they wanted a better predictability of the price of carbon to deal with because they had major investments to make. I can't give you a number that's used here, but you know, in the U.K., where there is some cap and trade, it's high. In the U.S., it's up a little bit. It's like $3 a ton. I don't know what you use here.
It varies, and we have different prices for different types of...
Different types of carbon.
Different types of credits. I guess I don't know what's in that the business model, but I think the key point is we do need a reliable indicator, and one of the things that business always looks for is, if not certainty, at least reliability in projections, and we don't have that at the moment, and that's why we do need some form of national scheme.
My name is Mark Sibri. I have my own consulting business. I notice on the platform and perhaps in the audience, we actually don't have the largest producers of carbon emissions in the state in terms of the generators, nor the largest users in terms of large smelters. I'm wondering if the facilitator might fill us in on what their policy stance might be.
Policy stances seem to be changing pretty rapidly across the nation and internationally as well, so it would be a bit adventurous for me to try and predict what their policy stance might be today, so I won't do that. But it's a fair question, and I'm sure that one that they'll be pondering pretty deeply. But I suspect in general, though, the conversation we've been having today about with these carbon innovators is really just that. It's the start of a conversation. I know in respect to my own business that to work towards becoming carbon neutral wasn't a simple task. We went to know a little bit about these things, and we found ourselves slow off the mark and confused at times. And on our web now you'll find our emissions inventory of the things that we're currently offsetting, and there's more to come as it doesn't just end there. The types of products we've used to offset, we found that there's a plethora of products and a lot of different underpinning of those products, and to get products that we were comfortable with took us a long time. So I think the conversation's what's important, and I'd like you to thank our five innovators for their contributions to the conversation today.